All right, Wednesday night edition of the pod, and a new guest that I wanted to bring on, a guy whose work has intrigued me, even going back to 2002 when I first started reading him. He's a bit of a shadowy figure because his Twitter handle is isn't really very self-explanatory, but his name is Ben Taylor. He's been doing an awesome series at his site, backpicks.com, with doing some historical rankings from a different perspective and with some data that I haven't seen anywhere else. So I wanted to have him on the show, talk a little bit about his philosophy, and then get into the historical rankings that he's done. He still has 8 to go, but I wanted to talk to him about his methodology and where he is so far through the 9 through 40, and then maybe we'll have him back on to talk about his top 8. But enough introduction here. We were just talking before the show of how I don't do that much introduction, but here's Ben Taylor. How you doing, man?
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here, and I have been described as many things. I don't know if shadowy figure is one of them.
your Twitter handle is LG35. Where does that come from? Because that is not, in fact, your initials.
Yeah, wow. No one has ever asked me that. So LG is for the phonetic letters L and G, just spelled out.
Yeah.
And that actually comes from a nickname that a girlfriend gave me a very long time ago, which stands for something that I can't repeat on air. And the 35 was my number when I played.
All right, well, that's that's a great way to get started. Yeah, I never really knew what that was. So it's just one of those sort of, you just have so many sunk costs now with that handle that you don't want to change it. You know, you can just change it and like you don't lose any followers. I used to be the Team Rebound back when I was working as a lawyer, and I wasn't sure whether I wanted people to know who I was at the law firm. I wasn't sure how they're going to take it. And then when I started with Basketball Insiders, I changed it to Nate Duncan NBA, and I didn't lose any of my 400 followers or whatever that I had at the time.
You know, it's serendipitous because I was just thinking today, is that just stuck in stone forever, or can I change it? So maybe I will now. Maybe you've inspired me.
So I introed you, shadowy figure intro aside, you do have a little bit different of an approach to analytics, to talking about basketball. You have your book that you've written as well, which we'll talk about. But what do you think is kind of separates your philosophy and some of your ideas from some of the stuff that we see more in mainstream NBA analysis?
Well, I think there's this classic dichotomy that exists between the eye test or film heavy folks and the analytics crowd. And I've always kind of felt that was a false dichotomy, that whether even going back to in high school when I played or would try to scout the opponent, you kind of want both, right? And I think there's as a social scientist, there's a bent there as well, where you're thinking like, okay, I wouldn't just get the data or measurements of anything. I also want to qualify it. I want to understand what it means in its context. And basketball to me is the beautiful game because it balances those things. Like baseball, very discrete, right? Everything's just these events, one event after another.
Right.
But in basketball, you have this balance of a tremendous amount of information, but you also need to know like, okay, what's the context in terms of offensive strategy? Are the lineups defensively slanted? Does a team play fast or slow? What's the balance between inside and outside fit? I talk about fit a lot. So I think that's sort of, I'm unique in the sense that I have a foot in both pools.
Well, and one of the concepts that I've started using, reading it in your latest series, is the idea of both scalability and the idea of floor raisers, and how there could be different skill sets that lead to those outcomes. You elaborate on those for the audience, kind of what you mean when you talk about those?
Yeah, definitely. So the original sort of concept came from all the research I did on trying to figure out the relationship between how much a guy impacts the scoreboard and his championship odds. And what emerged from that basically was it doesn't help as much to be able to take a poor offense and make them respectable if you then can't play the same game with better people around you. So the classic example is some isolation scorer. Back in the day, I used to to call it Iversoning the team, where you just be surrounded by a bunch of defensive guys and you give the ball to an isolationist. He can create for everyone else on the court, and he's just taken all kinds of crazy shots, and maybe he makes them at some moderate percentage, but he's not fantastic. How does that translate if you actually put better offensive players on the team? And so the original term that I came up with was portability, as an homage to the basically to the PDF, which has to do with how well do you interface with different guys in different teams. So scaling is a huge component of that, because when we say how much does his game scale, what we really mean is, can he hold value as he plays next to better and better players? Because there's only one ball, and this kind of got hot or big around the time of the Heatles, where you had redundancy being discussed a lot. So that's the idea. They go hand in hand. You can have a skill set that raises the floor of a team, but then that might not translate necessarily to a better offense, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I've been talking about this, I think, a little bit less eloquently than you just did, that there are some players that I view as, you know, having value in the NBA. They deserve to get paid. Guys who will get you from, you know, 30 wins to 45 wins, you know, or 25 wins to 40 wins. You know, I've thought of DeMarcus Cousins maybe as a guy like that. And part of that will be, you know, maybe because they're not as good defensively. Cousins, it's interesting, you know, he hasn't played with a lot of other star talent, but is a guy who's really high usage, not the greatest efficiency. He can at least shoot now, which he couldn't before, but then it has some defensive limitations. And, you know, I don't know, would you see him as kind of an example of the type of player that you're talking about in today's game?
He possibly. Cousins, to me, is, out of all the players in my sort of historical Rolodex, he's the biggest mystery to me.
because that's fortuitous.
We didn't plan this beforehand or anything. It was impromptu that you just brought him up. And he has this incredible statistical portfolio. I mean, he's clearly a very skilled passer. He's now a big that can hit threes. It's not like he's gone the way of
but
Antoine
not at
Walker.
Not at an amazing percentage, though. You know, he's shooting, yeah, like just enough that you have to guard him out there. But it's like, if he's like just a spot up threat from, you know, getting kickouts, it's kind of, it's to me that he's not like some big threat. But if you're guarding him one on one, you have to get out there and guard him. It's kind of, if he has the ball, it's an interesting, you know, there's not a lot of players like that, especially at the big position.
Right. Exactly. I mean, he actually, he shows up historically when you just filter by bigs among highest box creation numbers and assist percentages and things like that. So he's an intriguing case study to me, because on one hand, I think the short answer is, oh, well, maybe his defense is just really that underwhelming. On the other hand, it's like, how much is he helping on offense? Is it because of the teams he's on? And we can get into this later, but, you know, there's this relationship that exists between your role related to floor raising, of course, and what happens to your box score numbers. And sometimes you end up with these really gouty, sexy box score numbers, but as you try to scale up to a better team, it doesn't fit. I'm just not convinced with him. I've never done a deep dive, and maybe that's long overdue.
Yeah. So who are some other players in today's game you would view as floor raisers, but then maybe would not necessarily scale on a better team?
Well, I think even before I really came up with sort of formalizing these concepts more, Carmelo was one of the original guys we talked about years ago. And he's almost like passé, because he's such a common answer. But you got to think about the skills and sort of the core skills and how they interface together. So if you're a ball stopper and you like to isolate and you live in the mid post, or you take up that entire pinch post and you want to clear out and you're slowing the game down, like, how is that going to fit with ball movement or with other people that break down the defense? There's this relationship between creators and finishers, and sometimes isolationists don't fit into that scheme very well. So I think Carmelo is sort of one of the classic cases. Then one I wrote about for Nylon earlier this year is Westbrook.
Sure. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
He's really kind of the quintessential one, you would think.
Yeah. Exactly. And you see it in the data. We just passed Kevin Durant's profile this week, and there's a little blurb in there on Westbrook. And basically, when Durant is out of the lineup, the floor doesn't fall out, because Westbrook, he's such a tornado, right? He can carry so much and create so much, and his scoring rates himself are actually enormous. But then, of course, he's dominating the ball. And so when you pair him with better players, you know, he's not bad, right? But he's just not holding the same value.
So it's interesting that you mentioned Melo and you mentioned Westbrook. And those are guys who have played on some really good offenses,
yep,
right?
Yep.
So how does that to say, to me at least, and maybe you can correct me though, those guys don't fall into that category as much for me, because, you know, I mean, like, if you could just put a good defense around the offenses that they were on, you know, you're right at a championship level. It's the guys who are like, you know, and even if their own personal efficiency wasn't that high, they apparently are creating enough for others where they can be efficient and being on some good offenses, or you can play with a Kevin Durant type of player and still have a good offense. What's your reaction to that?
I'm so glad you brought that up. Another thing that we didn't plan, but I have Jedi teleported into your mind to ask about. This comes up a lot where people say, hey, how can you say this guy doesn't scale too well if he played on a really good team? And scaling poorly or not having great portability doesn't mean you can't play on good team. It just means that your value is diminished the better and better the talent around you is, right? So you can, Westbrook and Durant, and the fact that they had some good defensive talent there ends up producing fairly high-end clubs, but and this is, I think, another thing about my work that's fairly unique. I try not to get too focused on the one situation that we're looking at, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's a mental trap. It's totally a normal human reaction for us to not want to sit there and have these thought experiments about, well, God, what if he played with another ball-dominant wing? Like, you know, what if Kobe, instead of playing with Shaq, played with another Jordan type? Like, how would that work? And that's really what we're talking
about. Yeah, so, and I think that seems like one of the basis for your project that I thought was interesting. And obviously, if you're doing any kind of rankings like this, it's entirely subjective, and how you want to value certain things all time is entirely subjective. But we'll get into a little bit more of your methodology. You can do a quick ad read here, and we'll be right back with Ben Taylor. So it's a shame that Danny is not on this show, because he uses stamps.com all the time, because he has authored a book and he wants to send copies to people. And stamps.com makes that much easier by bringing all the amazing services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. I use it a lot too, especially for returning stuff that we all buy online these days. So often you buy stuff online and then you just don't really feel like doing it because you might have to go to the post office and send it back. But you can do all that from home with stamps.com. They allow you to buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. They even send you a digital scale, so that'll automatically calculate exact postage, avoid waste, and help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. There's no need to lease an expensive postage meter, and you don't have any long-term commitments with stamps.com either. You can enjoy their service with a special offer right now that includes a four-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Just go to stamps.com, click on that microphone on the top of the homepage, and type in CapSpace. That's stamps.com. Enter that CapSpace code. Easy to remember. We talk about CapSpace all the time on the program. They'll get you a four-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. That's stamps.com and the CapSpace code. Let them know that you came from us. So this is where I kind of wanted to start with you on your project, which was your methodology. It seemed to me like the idea is, if you just put this guy in any situation, you know, not necessarily by era, but just with different types of players, you know, just you kind of ran his career 1,000 times and he played on 1,000 different kinds of teams, how much value would have he added towards winning championships? Is that a decent summary of what you tried to do?
Yeah, that's a decent summary of what's been going on in my brain for the last year or two.
Well, I hope it's a little more than that.
Well, I don't leave the simulator on all the time. So that's exactly it. To your point, you can slice this thing many different ways. You can come up with a lot of different criteria. I wanted a criteria that essentially served as it's almost overly rigid, right? It's like, here's the approach. We're sticking to the approach. You know, Reggie Miller comes out 29th. That feels weird, but use the information and use the approach as you will, if you then want to fold back in your own criteria. For me, over the years, to your point about 1,000 simulations and whatnot, I just, it's too compelling for me. The evidence historically, when you go through these great players team to team, is too compelling for me to say, I'm only going to focus on, you know, I'm trying to think of a guy who's not in the top 8, because I'm trying not to say too much. But I'm only going to focus on Moses Malone when he's in a great situation. I'm not going to focus on him when he's in a situation that isn't as good. I just, that feels too arbitrary to me. So that's sort of how I ended up moving more and more toward trying to understand how you can build around guys, how they fit in different situations, how they fit in different lineups. I think it it lends itself really well to people who like to view if I drafted this guy, you know, how much value would I get throughout his career? That sort of that kind of approach.
Well, all right. So the way I'd like to get into this a little bit more here, rather than the nuts and bolts of your methodology, is let's talk a little bit about some of the players who deviated the most from what your pre-existing expectations were as you started this project, and then also who deviates the most from what the conventional wisdom was. And the one that really stuck out to me, which you asked on Twitter the other day, which one was my favorite, and I said it was Wilt Chamberlain, because that deviated the most from what my pre-existing expectations had been. So when you dove in to Wilt, what did you find about him that's a little bit different from what the conventional wisdom had been about his career?
You know, when I started with Wilt, because I'm often gravitating back toward the cognitive side of how we sort of perceive the game, and I talk about this a lot in Thinking Basketball, I was thinking, wow, Wilt gets really underrated because he lost, right? There's this idea that when you lose, people start sort of slanting negatively again. So that's where I started. And then you uncover, like, wait a second, his team's offenses weren't really that good when he was scoring a lot. I think that's the first big breakthrough to realize with him. And then there's the second thing is he actually starts to join these super teams, especially in LA, and not great stuff happens. So then that introduces you to the concept of fit. And that's why I actually started. Wilt was the first profile I wrote for the series. Wasn't even necessarily sure I was going to turn it into a top whatever series, because he's so foundational and so instructional in terms of looking at the relationship between scoring and the box score and creation and fit and all that stuff.
Yeah, because about a year, I can't remember if it was last year or 2 years ago, Kevin Pelton, I had him on Royce Webb, and we talked a little bit about Wilt. And I, you have more advanced statistical tools available at your disposal than I do and did at the time. But a lot of the players I would go back and just looked at, hey, you know, especially for the big men, you know, where did their teams rank defensively? And then, you know, going back to Wilt, I, you know, it's like, oh, he shot 50% from the field in that 1962 season when he averaged 50 points a game. And then you looked at it, but that was like, you know, number two in the league in field goal percentage. And he has this absolutely preposterous usage. So man, he must've just been an incredible offensive player, but apparently, you know, his teams weren't that good offensively. Even so, it's kind of Adrian Dantley disease, I guess, is another way to talk about it.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly what it is, which is not to say that either are negatives or anything like that. But the assumption, I think, there's this de facto connection historically between huge scoring and he must be an offensive force. Like I hear him described as like the most dominant offensive force ever. And it's like, well, it wasn't really actually overly efficient in terms of the team outcome. And of course, you know, we have pace. So people forget to adjust for pace. So they see the 44 and the 50 point season along with all the rebounds that were available. And they think like, wow, this guy must have been crushing it. But I think the other big thing is, which I've just alluded to, is creation. You know, like, are you setting up your teammate? And I actually, until this most recent pass, I didn't realize how the ratio between the amount he shot and the amount of assist he collected and how sort of outlying that was historically. I think that was a pretty revealing thing for me as well.
Well, and so when you say that, are you referring to the idea that like he either kind of passed or he shot, but he wouldn't try to shoot, draw the defense, and then pass to get other guys open? That's kind of what I took away from your analysis.
Yeah. For Wilt, he has this period in the first 6 or 7 years of his career, which I typically just call the volume scoring year.
Yeah.
And then I think what is so stunning that people may not realize, again, because of pace, is the shift. He goes from being the team's leading shot taker on a pretty regular basis as a guy who's getting the ball in the post and basically finishing or performing isolation. He's not creating a whole bunch. He's not carving up the defense like the modern offensive engines are. And then in 67, Alex Hannum comes in. He starts this period where I think he, per 36, goes from first to like seventh or ninth on the team in field goal attempts. And again, he's playing the whole game, playing 45, 46, 48 minutes. So he ends up averaging 20 points a game, but it's 110 possession pace that they're playing. And you look at that and you go like, oh, wow, he's actually not shooting that off. There's a huge difference in how he plays. And we've never really seen anything like that.
Yeah, just that change. And maybe that part of that, because I think, what was it, 60, that 67 year when they won this, went 68 and 13, that he led the league in assists. So it seems like a very conscious decision, perhaps informed by coaching. I mean, that was an unbelievable team that he was on, obviously one of the best in NBA history. industry to just pass a lot more. And so did you find that he was more helpful to the offense then as a passer? Was he really, you know, adding value there, or is he just more kind of serving as a hub and throwing it to guys once they became open, but not really, you know, passing guys open?
Yeah, this is I bring this up in the opening of the book because I think it's that fundamental. The shift from 66 to 67, we're very lucky that they didn't change much in those years. Really, Billy Cunningham, who is in his early years, ages, right? So he's got some maturity that you'd have to build into an aging curve, but they bring back the exact same lineup. And Alex Hannum comes in, who had coached Wilt earlier when he was with the Warriors. And he says, look, I want you to shift how you play and pass more. He actually led the league in assists in 68.
Oh, okay.
And it was in 67 that they sort of, he had probably the best balance he ever had between scoring and passing. But the big, I guess I'll tease what happens at the end of the first chapter. The big takeaway is the offense shifts to become the best offense up until that point in league history. They go from kind of like a ho-hum offense to, I think they're around like +5 in relative efficiency or something like that, which was a huge shift at the time. And, you know, that was like, okay, this is really working if you can find a balance between scoring and passing. And then Wilt ends up going too far in the other direction, to the point where there are games in LA at the end of his career where he wouldn't even shoot. He basically sort of assumes a Tyson Chandler role at the end of his career. He's just a fascinating player to look at. We can talk about him forever, probably.
Yeah, and I'm sure we're going to talk about some other people, but your conclusion that his defense was pretty underrated is an interesting one, especially given his reputation of like not really being a winner, but then he did kind of this hidden stuff that people didn't really realize as much. And so this is something else that you mentioned, was that we're between 66 and 67, we're lucky that they didn't change anything, but it is those changes in the lineups that it seems like enabled you to, at least for some players, where some guys who are in the lineup all the time, it's tougher to do, to kind of approximate what we have these days in on-off statistics by just looking at games where they played and didn't play, or when certain players left the team and went to others. So can you describe a little bit more about what you did to try to fill in the gaps in what you call the pre-data ball era?
Yeah, so if you think about, we have play-by-play right now, which is the basis of on-off, and we've had that for over 2 decades.
But 96-97, is that the first year, 96-97, that we had that?
96-97 is the first year we have full play-by-play, and then we're very lucky, the legendary Philadelphia 76ers statistician Harvey Pollack, he published in his logs, he used to put out like an annual catalog or something. He did the NBA's plus-minus for 94, 95, and 96. Not play-by-play, but the total plus-minus. So we've got almost 25 years of plus-minus data. But that's all at sort of a guy checks in, a guy checks out. It's at the play level, okay? Before that, the technique that I started using years ago was to look at the game level and say, what happens if you have the exact same lineup, but a guy misses 10, 20, 30 games? What happens when you trade for someone, which occasionally happens, and the guy you traded for, you cut, or he's injured and doesn't play? So you basically end up with these controlled situations where you have A, B, C, D, and E, and then you have A, B, C, D, E, and F, and you can compare the two. So that was sort of the first technique to try to look back in time and get something that wasn't box score based, right? Get something that was more of an impact measurement. That was the first.
Another thing that you've done a lot of is hand tracking, where obviously it's not possible to do that on an enormous scale, but I think, you know, maybe on average you're doing like how many for this series? I mean, obviously, you know, Bob Pettit, there's not much film available of him, but how many on average possessions are you able to do with your hand tracking for most of these guys?
Most of the ones who had a full profile, I would say the low end was in the 600s, and then there were other guys that are over 1,000. It becomes a balance. At a certain point, you watch some film and you see like, okay, you have the offensive tendon. They just keep coming up over and over and over again. So, right. So then at that point, it's a question of, all right, can I get a big enough enough sample to at least have a ballpark feel for what's happening with the phenomena I'm trying to track. That is to say, passing, vision, defensive tendencies, right? Like, how often do you have a breakdown? Some of those things only happen a couple times every 100 possessions. So you want a bigger sample, but at a certain point, you're like, okay, I got to do something else with my life. that's the balance.
So tell us what you hand check, what stats you come up with that, you know, we haven't really seen necessarily elsewhere in our basketball statistical universe.
So most of them are around things, of course, that aren't captured traditionally. And that means help defense kind of stuff, some on-ball defense stuff, and a lot around passing. I feel like passing in general is sort of a space that isn't fully fleshed out. Like, even when you watch a game, certain passing concepts or opportunities aren't discussed. It's very rare. So I've obviously watched a lot of tape recently and over the years. Very, very rare for even a color commentator to say, hey, you know, he missed a man. He missed a cutter. He missed a guy under. And they're there. You know, I'm showing them. Sometimes they're incredibly clear. But so just this entire realm of passing, I started with saying, okay, when are you missing good passes? When are you making high leverage passes? That was one big thing. And then defense can be a little trickier. It almost reminds me of getting in to try to grade football sometimes, especially.
Yeah. I mean, this is what I've been wanting to ask you, because, you know, you have in there like, okay, he had a breakdown. You show some film examples of it, but I mean, what's kind of your rubric for determining when a breakdown has occurred?
Yeah, you have to go in with a working assumption. Every once in a while, there'll be something where you'll look at the play three or four times. So one thing I do, by the way, is I watch plays over and over. They have a little button that just lets you watch the play over and over. I recommend that a lot because it's hard to see everything. And then when you do that, every once in a while, there'll be a breakdown, but I'll look at it and I'll be like, okay, it's possible that there's some realistic scheme here where they want to play the pick and roll that way, or yeah, it's totally someone else's responsibility. And asking that second level defender to come over is really asking him to make a great play versus a breakdown. Those are two different things, right? The inability to make an elite, incredible recovery that covers for someone else's mistake is different than being responsible for making the mistake in the first place.
Sure. Yeah. So it's kind of, you have the expertise, but it really is just kind of subjective when it all comes down to. I mean, it's, and I don't know that it is possible to come up with something objective for that.
Yeah, I think of it as subjective. I think it's less subjective in certain older contexts. I think the game now is more complex.
Yeah.
And the defensive coverages now are more complex. When I break down film from the last 5 years, even, there's a lot more to saying like, okay, someone missed a rotation there. Whereas in the old days, especially the period from like 82 to 02, where you had the old illegal defense rules in, the rotation responsibilities were pretty standard. You know, every team sort of had this, like your high block, low block. If you had like on a string rotations, it was pretty clear who missed stuff there. So there is a subjectivity to it that, to your point, I'm just like with grading football or something, I'm not sure you can ever get around without being the coach.
Yeah. I mean, and it's the same thing, even, you know, when we're doing our live call or we're talking about on the podcast, right, that there is a breakdown. I mean, you try to do the best job you can, but you don't know for sure. And I mean, I think it's a little better to just kind of do it like, okay, this was a breakdown and this happened, if you're not trying to then say, okay, this is the breakdown, we're assigning, you know, -5 points for my overall value metric from this. Like, that's when I think it really kind of gets dicey, as opposed to just being like, okay, this is another tool that we're going to use. You know, I just subjectively saw that this guy had X number of breakdowns, and you compare that with other guys, it's not as often, you know. So if you want to kind of grade it on its scale, just using it as its own tool, as opposed to then trying to translate it into like, okay, you know, this guy, you know, these are definitive defensive rankings, or he cost his team X number of points with this. Like, that's where I think it gets a little more difficult.
Right. Agreed. And I think that's the spirit, to say everything that's happening on the court has some level of context. This gets us back to, you know, how I ended up starting to view things is, maybe we shouldn't just judge that one situation. Maybe we should think of how this extrapolates to more situations, because some guy may have a higher rate of elite passes or layup passes that he hits or something, but he also might have the ball a lot more. He also might be, to what's happening nowadays, when I see like the Harden Rockets, right? The court is so spaced out.
Oh, yeah.
That your passing lanes are better and your rotation medications are harder. So it makes sense that he's going to have a higher ratio of something. And you can take that in a smaller scale and apply it to any team historically, right? The context is going to inform whatever measurement, whether it's in the box score or whether I hand track it. And so that's the spirit of just saying, like, here's the data, here's what happened. It's a proxy for something. It's very hard to get it perfect.
Hey, you mentioned the spacing. One of the pieces you wrote recently was just a kind of visual history of NBA spacing. So if you're going to say, you know, obviously we know what it is now with a team like the Warriors, we know what it is with a team like the Rockets. In contrast, Oklahoma City last night had no spacing against the Rockets, right? They're because they just weren't guarding Hustis or Grant or any of these guys, you know. So it's not all teams that you're going to have that level of spacing, but at least they're going to have them try and stand further away, even if you're not guarding them. But can you summarize that piece for us a little bit of, like, you know, what did you see as some of the main tactical changes evolving through the decades in NBA spacing?
Ooh, it was, first of all, I think it's more important than is ever given credit for when we talk about history. And the first thing, which is related to the spacing, was the dribbling and palming and traveling rules. And I have a clip coming up in one of the top eight profiles that was called for a travel. And I hope people rewatch it as many times as I have, just to see how it could humanly be a travel. It's like a half a step. It's like a zero step travel.
Yeah.
And so I think we forget that this was the environment back then. And the way this connects to spacing is, if it's harder for you, think of like hockey or soccer, if it's harder for you as a perimeter player to navigate with the ball, right? Then the approach back then was, well, we gotta pass it to places, and we gotta use screens, and we gotta dump it into our big people, because we can't get space for these one-on-one players to work, because they'll be called for a travel, or they'll be called for a palming or something. So that was the first huge thing where people are talking about spacing. They're trying to improve spacing. You see it in the old literature, like the 68 Lakers. Van Bredekhoff came in, and he had this whole like, oh, we're gonna do the Princeton offense. We're gonna bring the bigs up. We're gonna have the lane wide open. So this stuff was going on for a while, but it just slowly took forever to get to the 3-point line. And you would think, okay, we've got the 3-point line. The ABA had the 3-point line long before the NBA. And the ABA, when I watched the film, has much better spacing.
Oh yeah, I mean, there were guys in the ABA who were, you know, making like 3 or 4 3-pointers a game,
right?
You know, or taking like, you know, 7 or 8 or something like that. I mean, maybe I'm overstating a little bit there, but compared to you know, the NBA when it first came in 79, I mean, it took like probably to like the 90s for the NBA to get to the spacing and 3-point attempt rate that the ABA had.
Right, exactly. It wasn't 7 or 8, but the difference was they shot them.
Yeah.
And when you know, you look at the way they spaced the court, they actually had guys spotting up behind the stripe as a weapon. Whereas in the NBA, they almost eschewed it. It was like, it didn't even exist. You watch some of the Lakers-Celtics games from the early 80s, and everybody's inside the 3-point arc. And you're like, wait a second, what's going on here? So yeah, it took a long time for the three-point shot to catch on. I think in 95, shortening the line.
Yeah.
And if you look at the historical trends, right, that was an inflection point that it never recovered from. Because even when they brought the line back out, I think coaches just realized how you could weaponize it. So the long-winded answer, Nate, is penetrators and guards have, over the years, almost every decade, they've had more and more space to work with. So you give them the ball more, their assists go up, their points go up, and you end up with this like super engine concept. Again, James Harden, LeBron's had it for a while, where you're like Jordan and Magic put together, because you just get the ball and you score 30 and you dish out 12 and, you know, Bob's your uncle. Good to go.
So let's talk about a few more.
I threw you with the Bob's your uncle. I know.
Yeah.
What is that from?
What is that from?
I don't know. That's an expression. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. I got that confused with the not great Bob for Mad Men, but yeah, the good news is I have a tool that like truncates all the silences, so it's actually gonna sound very seamless. who are some of the other guys who really deviated in your rankings? And you can see the full rankings at least through the top eight. I think he's gonna be done in like a month or so with the top eight. But you've got like 9 through like 32 or something right now, so you can check that out at Backpack. comicbooks.com. But what were your findings? Actually, you know what? Let's do a quick read here now that I've teased it, and then we'll get to more of the interesting players in his rankings right after this. So if you are someone who enjoys making the games a little more interesting, a great place to do that is at MyBookie. Their site is mybookie.ag. with college hoops going on in the madness of March, or even if you think you might get a little advantage during tanking season here in the NBA, check out MyBookie. When you win, they pay fast and without any hassles. And they even have in-game live betting, so you can place a bet after tip-off, should you so desire. If you join now at MyBookie, they will match your first deposit with a 50% bonus, and you can enter for a chance to win their $1 million bracket challenge. Use that familiar promo code CAPSPACE to activate the offer. Go to mybookie.ag. That's mybookie.ag. Enter that familiar CAPSPACE code, which we talk about all the time on the program. Play, win, and get paid. Mybookie.ag, promo code CAPSPACE. Let them know that you came from us. All right, so who are the other players who both either with your, from your preconceived notions or the general conventional wisdom deviated from that?
Well, we mentioned Reggie Miller earlier. I think he's one. And I've always been higher than normal, even just back when he played, because I was sensitive to sort of the gravity effect that he had when he spaced the court. I think the other thing about Miller that gets so lost is he seems to be penalized for coming off screens, working off the ball, that whole sort of approach to offense, when I actually think that's one of his most valuable weapons. Because how do you defense a bunch of big men setting screens? How do you defense the counters on his cuts? I think that's perhaps one of the reasons why he was so good in the postseason. And we can talk about that later if you want to talk about other guys in the postseason. But he's like, what he was able to do in the playoffs is kind of mind-blowing when you stack it up next to other players in history. So that's one,
yeah.
Reggie Miller.
Yeah, and he wasn't the highest usage guy. I mean, if I recall, like, I don't think he ever really had a usage more than maybe like 22 or 23%. You could correct me if I'm misremembering there. But, it wasn't like the level of most big superstars that we see. But he was incredibly efficient, so he's able to be a big scorer. And then his offenses that he played on always seemed to be really good, perhaps because of that spacing, perhaps because of that gravity off the ball, where the defense would really have to tilt to him when he came off a screen.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. His regular season usage was always lower than his postseason usage. He gets in the playoffs, he kicks it up, the scoring goes up, and he's got this like upper echelon, just incredible efficiency, and it doesn't really budge. And he did this against some of, his most famous escapades are against the Knicks, and those Knicks defenses were loaded. So he did it against really good defenses. He did it, at a higher rate in terms of scoring and usage in the postseason, but he didn't have an efficiency drop off. And I think historically we've looked back, and there's a passage from Bill Simmons' book, A Basketball, where he just says like Miller's an 18-3-3 guy, and it's like 18 points, 3 assists, 3 rebounds. And it's like, okay, number one, he doesn't get offensive rebounds just the same way Dirk doesn't, because he's out on the perimeter playing away from the ball. Number two, yes, he's not a great passer or creator, but he's making up for that in spacing, and that wasn't something that was really discussed. So he's sort of historically been lost in the shuffle as this, like, the other term about him is, well, he's a one-dimensional three-point shooter. And it's like, that kind of misses some stuff too, because he's hitting defenses with something that's far more effective than just, say, having an Antoine Carr jump hook in the post. Do you like that big dog reference I threw in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think they might have like played Antoine Carr even at the three. Someone was talking about that at times in like in the NBA finals. That's crazy. But yeah, it's like, and he was really, I think, the first guy who had the ability to come off of screens and shoot a three-pointer off the ball. I can't maybe Dale Ellis would have been in that category too. I can't really think of any others at the time. Miller preceded Glenn Rice by a little bit, but those, especially doing it with the longer three-point line as opposed to that shorter 22-foot line.
Yep, exactly. The archetype, I almost argue that the archetype goes back to John Havlicek, who would just run all the time through screens in the old Celtics offense. And then there was a player named Sweet Lou Hudson, who was an all-star kind of wing player who had a similar game, but they didn't have a three-point line, to your point. And Miller was the one who, I mean, he started shooting more threes than you would want to shoot. We got to pause for a second and go back to what we were saying about the three-point shot not not catching on. There were people who didn't like the shot because you couldn't make it at a high percentage. And it genuinely took that, took that long for the math to catch up. Yeah. And I remember Don Nelson, zany Don Nelson, who always had these outside the box ideas, when he was coaching the Mavs, I want to say at the end of the 90s, they were terrible.
Right.
And he literally came up with this, at least ostensibly, came up with this plan where he said, look, we're just going to shoot like 40 threes a game. And people were like, that's crazy. You can't shoot 30 or 40 threes a game. He's like, we only got to make them at like 33%.
Yeah.
I don't think it worked. I don't think it worked out very well. But that's a good segue, unless you want to talk more about Miller, that's a good segue to another player that I think is worth discussing, which is Steve Nash.
Yeah. And Nash, I mean, if you go back to the time of those MVPs, a lot of the people who were more statistical analysis focused at the time with the metrics that were available, you know, on off was just barely beginning to get into the consciousness publicly with 82games.com at that point in 05 and 06. But that MVP selection for him in those back-to-back years was pilloried. But I think if you go back and look at it, where he was in terms of just the quality of his offense and the on-off metrics, in addition, obviously, to the skill that he showed on film, perhaps those were a lot more justified than people gave him credit for at the time in the advanced community, despite the fact that the conventional wisdom at the time was, okay, he is the MVP.
Right. I think, one, he's got the points per game thing being held against him, and being a short white Canadian dude, that was always something that kind of people said, okay, he may be good on offense even though he doesn't score much, but how good can he be, and his defense must be terrible. And so the first hurdle to overcome, which I, as you said, with 82 games was entering into the consciousness, was the fact that, like, okay, his approach offensively is having this huge team effect. And when he goes off the court, the team, they're a good offensive team, so they don't fall apart, but they're pedestrian. And when he's on the court, they're like literally the best offenses ever. That's a pretty significant thing. I think it was Kevin Arnovitz who did a video series back in the day on basically like how good Nash was running pick and roll. That was really the first time, maybe around 2010, that I started to revisit that whole thing. But there's still a second hurdle to get over with Nash in terms of how people historically assess him, which is what happened in Dallas. So when you go under the hood, the impact metrics in Dallas are kind of pedestrian.
Yeah.
And the narrative that emerged was, well, it was the rule changes. It was D'Antoni. It was the system. That's what it was. It was Nash got lucky to be in a perfect situation. And when he was with Dallas, it didn't work out well. And oh, by the way, he left Dallas, and then Dallas became incredible, and Dirk won MVP. And so how good can Nash be? And so the big revelation for me this time around was going back and watching those games, connecting some of the data and saying, wait a second, Nash, he gets a little better in Phoenix. I think his conditioning was far improved with the famed Phoenix medical staff.
Yeah.
But he's kind of playing the exact same way. I was blown away at how good his passing was in 2001. And that's kind of when those young guys burst out on the scene and they upset Utah in the first round. And I think they played the Spurs decently in the second round and kind of bowed out. But you just go back and you look at that and you're like, okay, wow, this is more about fit. This is more about something else is going on here just beyond the rule changes or Nash getting lucky. Final point of the story is, of course, when D'Antoni leaves, Nash is still fantastic. So the whole thing, his entire career, that stretch from 2001 to about 2010, 2011, he's really incredible offensively.
Yeah, and people forget that those Dallas teams as well were some of the best offenses in NBA history relative to the league, when that was really a nadir for point per possession scoring overall.
Right.
So exactly. Nash you had at 19. You had Wilt at 9. Miller was 29th, which I think would be a lot higher than a lot of people would have. What about the people who were a little bit lower than maybe would have been expected?
Ones from the list or guys that didn't even make the cut?
Well, I guess we'll do the list for now. Well, so Moses Malone at number 24 guy who I think would most people would probably have in the teens as a guy. You know, I think he's probably the lowest of anyone who won three MVPs. That's for sure. Yeah, yeah. So why was it that he wasn't as high for you as for some others? Because he's a guy that I think, in part maybe because he passed away and didn't really have much visibility at the end of his career. You know, people don't know as much about, but you know, there are a lot of people who obviously are very high on him.
Well, he's very good, obviously. But you're right. That's a lower ranking than he's typically given. I think the first thing about Moses is offensively, he's a fairly unique offensive player. He's got no ability to pass whatsoever. Like, he cannot make his pass to him was a shot off the glass to himself.
Yes, exactly.
That's the old joke, right? So that's number one. He did get a lot of offense through his offensive rebounding, which is very valuable. And I think that's where I sort of give him a lot of credit. But the other big thing is his defense. He's when you're a, you know, 6'11 center and you want to be considered an all-time two-way player, you also have to have some high-end level of defense. Not that he was a bad defensive player, but it's hard for me to see on film or in the data sort of where he's providing a lot of defensive impact.
Yeah, and he doesn't really have the type of, I mean, if you just look at him, he doesn't have the type of body or length or explosiveness that you would necessarily associate with some of the guys that we know are the great defenders today, with having more metrics at our disposal.
Right, exactly. And I think he gets a lot of historical credit for the three MVPs. I don't love legislating MVPs historically, but certainly one of his MVPs on a 500-ish team. It was a very strange vote if you go back and look at it. And then in 83, so he Philadelphia.
He won it in what, 79, 81, and 83 off the top of my head?
Right, because 82 was Dr. J, and 80 was 80 Kareem's last one.
Yeah, I think
that, I'm sure we have 80 was internet. We can check this.
Yeah, there's no way we could possibly look this up. Let's just like continue to like quiz each other.
It's not like we're near a computer or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, 83 and 81, I know he had. The third one is the one that I'm missing, and I want to say it was 79 because it definitely wasn't after 83. So yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it was. But anyway,
The second thing about Moses is his number of high end years was fairly short,
right,
for one of these all time guys. And whether that was conditioning or lethargy or, you know, I don't know. But the 84 team was considered kind of a disaster at the time. They had a bounce back year in 85. And then once he kind of leaves Philadelphia, he's really in like second stage of his career mode. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's no longer a stud. And then he retires and people look back and they go, well, let's see. He's got three MVPs. He's got a title on one of the great teams ever. And he played like 39 years in the NBA and the ABA. So he checks a lot of boxes. I think he's got to be one of the best ever. And I think that's the typical approach to him. But using this method, he falls short not only in peak season, but in longevity too.
Yeah, longevity in terms of like longevity of like actually, you know, really elite the
actual
level
valuable.
Of seasons.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
And off, so he didn't really pass. So a part of your problem then is that he's not really creating that much for others. And, you know, as a one-on-one scorer, he wasn't like unbelievable. You know, I think he was good, but then, you know, the offensive rebounding was enormous. And I think maybe part of the reason too, perhaps, that people gave him so much credit is just like that was one of those things that was so incredible that just people just didn't know how to deal with it. It just stuck out so much. It was so demoralizing for the opposition that maybe that had an outside effect on how he was viewed historically.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, if even just going through the film, his offensive rebounding is absurd. You know, his ability to leap quickly. And then another big thing with offensive rebounding, and guys like Barkley had it too, the use of the hips and just like how he would kind of just snuggle the backside in and clear out space. And you're like, wait, how did he get there?
I would call that the use of the ass personally, but yes, I know Jimmy, he had this move where he, you know, if a shot went up, he would point his toes towards the baseline. He'd be almost under the backboard. And as the shot's in the air, he would just slam his butt into guys and carve out space so that he's just right there under the rim and the ball could just fall right to him. It was really awesome. I tried to do that when I was in high school. Unfortunately, I weighed about $170 back then, so it didn't work quite as well for me. But every once in a while, if someone was watching the shot, I could like really slam into him and maybe move him a little bit.
You know, I don't. And the thing is, I don't know if you can do that anymore, because if you're big and you get yourself situated way down on the baseline under the hoop, how are you going to get back in transition D? Your coach is going to be yelling at you the whole way back.
Yeah.
So, you know, the other tendencies of the game that have shifted over the years like that kind of make that a very very unique sort of phenomenon in NBA history.
The last guy that I thought deviated the most maybe from the conventional wisdom, you had David Robinson at number 15. And he, to me, is someone that the stats have always seemed to kind of like a little bit more. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think your methodology did not focus as much on playoff success, championship success, as some others, just with the idea that you wanted to kind of be a little bit more context independent.
Right, right.
But so why does Robinson rate so highly at number 15?
So to be clear, I care about the fact that you can still play in the playoff.
Yeah.
But whether you end up on a team that wins, that's what I was trying to separate from. Robinson, he's another guy who took me a long time to come around on, because I think, again, we tend to focus on the box score and we tend to focus on his value or even certain bigs' value as a scorer offensively, and we leave the defensive side apart. One, he was one of the best defensive centers ever. I mean, I don't think a lot of people dispute that. He just has all the tools, pops on film, all the numbers historically, just a phenomenal defensive force in the middle. So he always had that going. Where he fell short was he had these really sexy regular season box score numbers, and then you get in the playoffs and they would shrink a little bit. Most players have some small fall off when they go in the postseason. I think that's a natural function of playing first harder defenses, and then second, getting to game plan for someone for seven games, getting to game plan against an offense for seven games. In Robinson's case, it was more severe, and this brings us full circle back to portability, because before ever thinking about those concepts, you look at this team in the 90s before Tim Duncan comes and you say, oh, I see Robinson can't carry a team. But what he can do really well on offense is be your second best offense player. He's a good and willing passer. He's a fantastic offensive rebounder. He moves without the ball. He can play pick and pop and pick and roll. So you get a pretty good finisher back in the day. Couldn't shoot the three, but they didn't have centers shooting threes back then. We're going to have to like explain that to young people one day that all centers didn't shoot threes. And so what you end up with is you end up with a guy who's basically a massive two-way talent who probably did it for longer than people realize. And then the last few years of his career, when Duncan was a little bit more the focal point of the offense, his defensive impact was enormous still. He really doesn't trail off until his last year or two. So you throw on another, 98, it's another 4 years where he was a really, really good player. And you end up with a career that I think it surprised me too. When you look at it, you're like, wow, it's hard to take a lot of guys over this career.
Do you make any kind of an allowance for the fact that he didn't come into the league until he was 24 just because of the naval obligations, whereas, you know, especially in this era now, Moses came in earlier, or, you know, Kobe Bryant or LeBron or those guys are gonna get five more years than some of these guys who just, you know, were in an era where they couldn't come into the league that early?
Yeah, I don't, and that's another area where I feel like it's an overly rigid criteria, but it serves the purpose. You know, it's you can then make that mental curving on your own. Because
you don't know what would have happened to those guys in those, you know, I mean, you either did it or you didn't at some level. Like you can project a little bit, but yeah, I mean, it's hard to just give guys additional seasons that they didn't play, even if it wasn't because of injury, even if it was, you know, just due to the circumstance.
Right. And I think Magic historically is that ultimate example of this, because he's usually up near the GOAT conversation, and people say, well, you know, how can I really penalize him? When he left in 91, he was still phenomenal. And that was a largely political thing, where maybe nowadays it wouldn't even be revealed that he had HIV and he would just keep playing. So I don't. The only adjustment I make is a small, basic, linear adjustment that says the later you came into the league, the less your longevity sort of counts. Guys now are playing longer and longer. So relative to that era, which is what I'm trying to evaluate, 10 years is no longer, you got to get 11 years to get 10 years, or 12 years to get 11 years ever.
Yeah, and Magic was number 10. Suffice to say, he would have been higher had he not lost those years.
Yeah, definitely. Magic, I mean, just the level he was playing at when he left, was he was still in the thick of his prime. And even when you see him 5 years later with his comeback in 96, he was still like a competent, he's just so good at reading the game. I think he gave up a lot. I think he'd be much higher.
Yeah, and we've got lots more to talk about here, but the last topic I want to get to for this show is who was really significantly actually better or worse in the playoffs than might have been expected? And then were you able to discern any patterns about types of players that were better or worse in the playoffs?
So Miller was incredible, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
The other guy, there are two guys in the top eight that I will skip over for now, who also, I won't reveal who those guys are yet. But out of guys who weren't in the top eight, Jerry West was a guy who improved his scoring and efficiency a little bit. Again, the normal sort of expectation when you go into the playoffs is your efficiency drops a couple percentage points. Your scoring may be the same or tail off just a little bit. So to go up is always a pretty impressive sign. And then there were two other guys, if you sort of talk about like top 50, top 75 talents of all time. Tracy McGrady was one.
He
went up in the playoffs. Yes. Yeah, so you can see how your impressions and your biases that you form.
Sure.
It's just fascinating. Yeah. Now, we should mention that he started relatively low in most seasons. He was not a high efficiency player.
Yeah.
The other guy who went up, same story. Low efficiency player. He gets in the playoffs is the original Isaiah Thomas. He actually cranks his volume up a little bit and basically maintains the same efficiency, which is pretty impressive. So that's a group of guys. And then I'll give you a couple more who maintain, because I think we can see an emerging pattern here. Kobe from his like 2006, 2007 to 2011. And I think I mentioned this in his profile. He's basically holds his regular season numbers, which is really good. Two other guys that did that, Allen Iverson and Dwayne Wade. Now, I don't know about you, Nate. When I look at that group,
yeah,
I see a lot of incredibly skilled wings who have robust, diverse scoring attacks, who also, to maybe to their detriment in the regular season, already take hard shots anyway. That's sort of the pattern I see. But you tell me what you think after hearing that list of names.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting because, and those guys kind of fall into the category we were talking about earlier, you might say, of, although Miller and West maybe not as much, but of guys who, you know, create a lot of shots, don't take right. great shots, who might be when you talk about floor raisers, but the also and maybe just because of the type of shots that they take just can never be that efficient overall, mm-hmm. even in the regular season. But then they also, just because they can make hard shots, you can only take so much away from them. And then even against harder playoff defenses, when perhaps more of those difficult shots need to be taken, that would be my hypothesis. Those guys are capable of making those shots, whereas maybe some other guys can't.
Right, exactly. There's an inelasticity to the game that I think might be perceived as a negative in the regular season, but comes back to provide sort of like this resilience, as I've also called it before, in the playoffs. So, by the way, a current guy who's probably going to pick up a Maurice Podoloff trophy shortly, James Harden, last couple years, his defensive numbers, I mean, his offensive numbers in the playoffs have been relatively similar to the regular season. I think he has a reputation of completely falling apart, but it statistically has not been the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's had maybe some clutch failures and also just that game six. And then the years before that, too. I mean, in that Portland series that they lost in 2014, I think it was way below his regular season numbers as well. So maybe that's part of that. And then going back to the 2012 finals is another thing that people point to as well. And I don't think he was that good in their 2013 series against OKC either. So who are the guys who fall off the most in the playoffs?
Oh, well, the first one that really stands out statistically is John Stockton. He's a extremely high efficiency, low volume type of scorer, and kind of the entire profile falls off in the playoffs for him. His efficiency drops. It's not like he's cranking up his scoring. His assists go down. I mean, the whole thing for him takes a pretty severe nosedive. Karl Malone, his teammate, also has some troubles. I talked about that in his profile, where his, you know, getting into the lane and finishing and getting easy buckets for him is a challenge. Kevin Durant's another guy who kind of has had some statistical, between his like incredible regular seasons, there's a pretty big fall off. David Robinson, sorry. Westbrook is also as well, so I guess he's on my mind. But
yeah,
that's kind of the traditional group of guys who see a significant fall off in the postseason. And then when you look and break it down, I mean, I want to hear your thoughts too, but I see patterns where when I look at Stockton, he had a hard time time creating his own offense. When I look at Malone, he had a hard time finishing in the paint, and a great jump shooter, but there's only so much you can rely on with your jump shot. Durant, my thing with Durant really is sometimes his handle just doesn't let him, he doesn't read defenses super well. So if you throw complex coverages at him, it kind of throws him a little bit. And then we obviously talked about Robinson and Westbrook already.
Yeah, to me, I think, and Stockton and Malone are an interesting one, right? Because they seem to be so system-based a lot of times. And for Malone, so much of what he would do was running the floor really hard or ducking in, getting great deep post position, right, right. Which Stockton would then find him on. The one thing, actually, I disagree with you on, I thought you were a little too dismissive of the ability to throw great post entry passes. Maybe as a former post player, I just appreciate that a little bit more. But I do think that there's maybe more value added if you can really do that well. Forgive me if I'm misstating your position there, because I think I remember you dinged Stockton. You're like, oh, well, a lot of these are like post entry passes. And, you know, if it's just like, all right, I'm going to hold it there and just throw it in, he's got great position, that's one thing. But if the guy's fronted or the guy ducks in real quickly, like, I think so many players miss those passes, to me, to the point almost that like no one even ever ducks in anymore in the NBA these days.
Nate, I thought we were friends. No, well,
did I misstate what you said, or are we just in disagreement?
I may have understated it. And that's, you know, it's been wonderful. I've been trying to keep up with the feedback, which has been incredible. But what's interesting is I agree with about 75% of the criticisms I hear. And that's a perfect example, right? Like post entries, I'll agree with you. Post entries can have a decent amount of value. So sometimes what ends up happening is you write the profile and stuff gets cut or edited or reworked and something just may be understated. So I didn't mean to gloss over that for old John.
Well,
because he was, you're spot on, right? Like some of his post entries were fantastic. And I think there was a synergy there between Stockton and Malone. And of course, to the tenor of the piece, I was sort of emphasizing that the pick and roll synergies are not the way we remember them going back in time. Like Nash and Amari had the pick and roll synergies that we attribute to Stockton and Malone, but that was a totally different thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of it was just, you know, screening off the ball, flex cuts, right. Like that. I mean, that's what they ran back then.
That was their thing.
Yeah. But the point that I was making initially was, you know, both of those guys, whether it was Stockton, who, you know, seemed to more capitalize on converting, you know, only the most judicious opportunities extremely well, but didn't really ever take bad shots or create, you know, what we would call bad shots or even, you know, medium difficulty shots. And then Malone, transition, quick post-ups, duck-ins, you know, as opposed to really going one-on-one in the post and creating really efficient shots. It's much easier to take those things away in the playoffs, would be my hypothesis, that you're playing harder, you're more locked in. They're not going to kind of just get you the way they do in the regular season by like playing harder than you or just being like a little bit smarter. You know, we don't go against these guys every night, so they have this great system and they're going to beat us, type of thing.
Right. Agree. I think sometimes we can overstate that effect, but
yeah,
I mean, even right over the course of, if you're out there for 80 possessions in a postseason game or 85 possessions, you just take away a couple of those cross screens or just you never give up that easy bucket, and that'll ding your percentages over time.
Yeah, and there's I think the Spurs in recent vintage, you know, people talk about, oh man, you never count out the Spurs. I actually think these Spurs teams, I mean, that 2014 was awesome. 2013, you know, they lost to a team that I thought was an all-time great team. But generally, you would have to say that the Spurs almost never overachieve their regular season performance in the playoffs. You know, I think they have, the talk is always, oh, Greg Popovich doesn't value the regular season, but I can't remember the last series that they won when they didn't have home court advantage. I think maybe it's been like, you know, one in this entire era that they've had. So it's really like they seem to be a team that gets a little bit worse in the playoffs because there's all this low-hanging fruit that you can take away during the regular season, whether it's, you know, cleaning up the defensive glass or getting back in transition or just not making mistakes. And so many buckets in the regular season are just the result of teams not playing hard or whatever. And so if you're reliant on just taking away that low-hanging fruit for the other teams or getting the low-hanging fruit yourself, that can go away in the playoffs.
You may or may not be onto something that maybe we want to talk about in another conversation. conversation.
All right, man. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Looking forward to having you back on once the rest of the list comes out, and we can argue a little bit more and arouse people's ire with the rankings, especially in that top group. But this is awesome. Tell people once again about your book and Twitter and backpicks.com and all that.
Book is Thinking Basketball. It's available on Amazon in paperback and Kindle. Backpicks.com is where you can find the top 40. And as of today, I am subject to change. I am LG35 on Twitter. I'm probably more responsive there than anywhere else. So I always love to chat about this stuff with people. So thanks. This has been super fun too. And I look forward to the next episode.
All right. Likewise. Thanks. It was great.